So we'll talk about flooding. There's generally three types of flooding: the riverine, that's your rivers and your streams that overtop their banks; coastal flooding, which is everyone knows what that is; and then urban flooding, that's when stormwater backs up in the streets, maybe inlets aren't cleaned, and you have flooding there as well. And then there's flash flooding, which is a very specific type of flooding that happens very rapidly when the capacity of a stream overflows and comes pretty quickly into an area. So flooding is actually the number one hazard in the county according to the county's hazard mitigation plan. And the hazard mitigation plan for the county was recently updated in 2016. It was adopted by the county in April, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So if you're not familiar with what a hazard mitigation plan is, it's essentially a plan that evaluates your risks and your vulnerabilities associated with natural and human-made hazards. And as part of that plan, strategies are developed to determine how to protect people and property from future events. So mitigation is essentially the things you do before a hazard happens to reduce the likelihood of, you know, loss of life, loss of property, et cetera. All counties are required, in states, are required to have hazard mitigation plans in order to retain access to FEMA grants. So they're updated every 5 years at the county level.
That's correct.
Okay. So these are the hazards that were profiled in the 2016 Hazard Mitigation Plan for Sussex County. And you can see the natural hazards. There's more of those that were that were profiled than the human-made hazards. And, of course, you can see flood is on that list. Specifically in talking about flooding, there's a section of in Sea Level Rise, there's a section of the HMP that documents responses gathered from local governments. So as part of the Hazard Mitigation Plan, all the municipalities in the county are required by FEMA to participate and sign on to the plan. And then also the part of the process is the county coordinates with other agencies as well and gets feedback too. So there was one issue identified by DENREC that I wanted to just point up, bring out as part of the discussion today regarding coastal erosion and sea level rise. They say that it's a hazard confined to the geographic boundaries of the Delaware Bay shore, the Atlantic coast, and the inland bays. And I just wanted to go back to here. With the hazards, the natural hazards, erosion was identified as a hazard, and specifically that was coastal erosion, right, Joe?
Yes.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So coastal erosion was brought up as a hazard in the plan, too. There was some modeling that was done in the plan. So this shows coastal flooding that could occur, storm surges from different categories of storms, you know, Cat 1 through Cat 4. You could see what the storm surge would be and how much land would be flooded through a major storm event. And then also there's modeling that's done to show the depth of flooding that could occur. So this shows half-meter flooding through 1.5-meter flooding in the flood depth in the 100-year floodplain. And then also as part of this modeling, they estimate flood losses. So the total potential annualized losses for the county is $129 million if there were an event to occur.
And just so I'm clear, because there's been a lot of maps that have been shown, that's mm-hmm. not sea level rise. It depends on how much you think sea level rise is going to occur. That's just like a flood event, like a
yes.
storm surge
yes.
type event.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nor'easter goes to the
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
The very first map was hurricane categories, level 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
That shows by the colors what areas of the county would be flooded based on the category storm. I probably should reword this. Past history, Hurricane Irene, Hurricane Sandy, 2012, we saw Category 1 flooding. Now, we from Emergency Management plan for Category 2. We always plan one category ahead of what you're typically projected so that we're erring on the side of caution. But that gives you an indication, particularly the reds. The red is the Category 4, which would predominantly be our worst case scenario. So that's where you're looking at where the potential flooding. Everything east of the red along the coast would be underwater. And if you also notice the western portion of the county, the Nanticoke River has it feeds into Laurel and Seaford. And Seaford has actually experienced flooding based on rain events they were on, they, I shouldn't say this jokingly, but I used to say they're on a five-year plan. They flooded in 2001, 2006, and 2011.
Yep.
So. And then the next map, if you could forward that. Yes, that's just a simple flooding event. That's what potentially could happen.
So like I mentioned, as part of hazard mitigation plans, they're required to have mitigation actions to address some of the hazards that are identified in the plan. And you can see some of these were brought up during the public comment period by this gentleman behind me here about CRS updating and the base flood elevations. I did just highlight the one in yellow there having to do with coastal erosion. So work with DNRIC and DLDOT to endorse federally funded restoration projects to restore portions of the county coastline that are experiencing significant coastal erosion both from rising sea levels and coastal storms. So like we just said here, coastal erosion was identified in the plan as a hazard, and this is a strategy about doing restoration type actions to help reduce some of that impact.
What we tried to do is look at initiatives that would create some conversations with various groups to start the planning, if you will. And that's where some of these strategies come in, talking with DNRIC, DLDOT, to look at erosion, stormwater management, those kind of things. Realizing they're very broad stroke initiatives, but the idea behind the plan was at least to start the conversation and maybe look towards that area.
So this is just showing that there's a whole lot of different models and applications out there that talk about and model sea level rise. This is one done by NOAA, and it models it from 1 foot all the way up to 6 feet. So you could go on that website and change the parameters and see potentially, you know, if you have extensive sea level rise, what parts of the county would be underwater. DNRIC, I think the gentleman mentioned, yeah, I know.
6 feet, we're
done. We can go, if you are interested, we can click on these and look at them right here. Today, if you'd like. Sea level rise was mentioned, too, through the DNRIC modeling, the inundation maps. They do theirs in meters, in the half meter up to, I guess, I'm not sure what they go up to off the top of my head. But, yeah, you can also see with their modeling what's done. And then there's lots of different reports out there, too. This is a pretty recent report that was done in 2017 by University of Delaware and Sea Grant. And it specifically was looking at tourism impacts that could happen from sea level rise. So this table from that report shows how much land and state parks and wetlands could be lost from a half meter to 1.5 meter sea level rise by 2100. So it shows you the range. And also roads that might be underwater too. Okay, so then I was going to move on and talk about buffers. Do we have questions for Mr. Thomas about the impact of flooding in the county? Do we want to talk about sea level rise now or later? We want to make sure we use his time as best possible.
Is he getting ready to leave, or are you going on?
Well, we don't get to strategies for quite a while, so there's other things we talk about, like buffers, TMDLs, ag preservation.
No, but I meant you're getting ready to leave right now, right?
When we were done here, I was going to go ahead and leave.
Well, just I went online a few days ago, actually, and what's online is the 2010.
Yes, that is correct. That was
16 is not available. Or?
That was the plan we put online for public comment when we were actually going through the review process, and that's something that, to be honest with you, I hadn't realized that we hadn't put the new plan out there. Council approved it April 11th of this year, the 2016 version, which Alexis showed. So that's something we have to get out there. I thought it was already out there. My apologies.
No, and I checked it again just in case, you know, it went online since I've been online, and the 2010 is still the one that's on the website.
So what we can do is I can supply it to make sure you folks get a copy of it, but we'll also make sure it gets
put on. Or just put it online and let us know, and we'll go on and look it up. You know, it's easy. And then, I mean, I assume we're going to trust the government more than we trust everybody else. So we're looking at, you know, 1.5 feet of sea level drive rise at a minimum using their numbers. So what do you do, evacuate Dewey, or what do we do?
Well, what we're trying to do is create a conversation, if you will, and start the conversations with the various groups of maybe we need to look at sea level rise. It's actually not a rankable hazard in the plan, but we did put it in there as a comment that it needs to at least be considered in future discussions. Pretty much all of our information, we worked with DENREC. We got a lot of the information from them. They sat on our committee to review this, as well as all the municipals. So what we were looking at is actual incidents or occurrences for these hazards. Flood is the absolute number one hazard in the county. There's been over 60 recorded by the National Climate Data Center since they started collecting data. So that's where that came from.
Okay, well, I mean, where I look at it is, what can we do, the county? We know soil conservation is working on stormwater management, right? We have freeboard ordinances, and we'll continue to look at those, I presume, periodically to see if they need changing. So the next thing for us is, how do we notify residents for evacuation? DelDOT takes care of the evacuation routes, signage, and all that sort of thing, traffic control. What, you know, is there a way that we can improve in our notification processes to people that might be in danger because of a nor'easter or a storm that comes up the coast?
What we do is, we are responsible for identifying the evacuation routes within the county. DelDOT, as you said, maintains the roads. They sign the roads. What happens is that during one of these events, we activate our emergency operations center, which we bring in DelDOT, State Police, the National Guard, if activated, all the players that will coordinate this. And once we determine that we need to issue an evacuation order, we will use multiple platforms to do that with. We obviously use the media. We put out press releases. We have a, for lack of better words, it's called the Delaware Emergency Notification System, but most people would refer to it as a reverse 911. We also utilize our social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and we also can access, if you've ever been near a severe thunderstorm, in fact, last week when we had the tornado in Greenwood, if you were in the Greenwood-Bridgeville area, your phone went off and said that there was a tornado warning. It's called iPause. We also have access to that. So we have multiple platforms to notify people, and we're also putting information out days ahead of an event. For hurricanes and coastal events, we typically have 2 or 3 days to plan and get the word out. And what we're hoping is by putting that information in the public's hands, we're giving them the opportunity to make a sound, safe decision that if they need to leave, they need to leave. Now, unfortunately, some people don't heed our warnings, but we put it out there. So the part, as far as the hazard mitigation plan, the idea behind that is, let's look at ways to lessen the impacts that we've seen in previous years. And how can we do that? Is that through awareness? Is that through building code standards? Is that through looking at where we're having the building, the construction at? Those are all things that are taken in consideration. I hope I answered you.
No, you're good.
Okay.
Silence is golden.
I think we're good to proceed.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. If there's follow-up questions later in the day, I'll coordinate back with you after.
Yes.
Well, I think, I do think when we get down to the strategies part of things, mm-hmm. we may have some additional questions, and if we do, we certainly would like to invite you back.
Yeah,
to,
just let me know. I should be able to come back later
this,
on.
This won't be the last time we talk about conservation,
right.
I'm sure. So.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
All right, then. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So the 2008 plan, the conservation element, this is the outline of what it looked like. The first part of it talked about the protected lands, the federal, state lands under conservation easements that may be the land trust, the gentleman that spoke this morning, Ducks Unlimited. There's a number of different groups that have conservation easements. And then regulated wetlands are also considered protected lands in the plan. It talks about some of the major conservation initiatives that were taking place, such as the work the Center for Inland Bays is doing. And then the last part of the chapter has to do with strategies for conservation. So this is the map we saw last week, or two Fridays ago, without the trails on it. But it shows the forest lands, anything that's considered a park. And this is classified based on the GIS data. Wildlife areas, forest land preservation, nature preserves, and then ag preservation. All on
that's
here.
Current, right?
Mm-hmm. That's okay. All the latest GIS files. And all of that together is about 161,000 acres. That doesn't have wetlands on there. And also keep in mind that the ag preservation does include the districts. So those are 10-year easements that farmers have the option of, getting out of the program. But we're considering it protected for now because it is protected for 10 years at least.
Can you go back just real quick?
Sure.
Of those different categories, or are all those lands owned by the state or whatever, are they public access or not?
It's a mix. And, yeah, some are private, some are public access.
But, like, state forest lands, are they public access?
I believe so. At least some of them have trails on them.
And the park lands are definitely public access, right?
Yeah, so those include, like, Cape Henlopen, and also, just municipal parks are thrown in that category, too, in the GIS data.
Wildlife areas are public access, right?
I think it varies, and same with the nature preserves.
I think some of that depends on if it's limited.
Right.
It's public, but it's also limited to some degree.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the Redden State Forest is on there, and I don't think...
I think there's trails there.
Wander through. I think they closed them down because
they
didn't have anybody to... they were having some issues with...
Well, that's just the pavilion and the picnic area there that was
same thing
closed.
With Prime Hook. I mean, it's...
Yeah. Exactly.
It's not, just
open. Well, there's a wildlife area
it's
against
open.
My farm.
It's open. You can bird there. You can go birding.
And I know there's public access to the wildlife area, at least to one adjacent to my farm, for hunting or whatever. There's rules, but there's still access.
Right.
And so, I'm trying to understand how many acres, because we divide the pie up into so many pieces. Why can't we just... couple them all together, those state-owned properties that have public access into one color rather than having three or four colors?
I mean, we can classify it however you'd like. This just, to show the state forest land, I think, was important to see Redden State Forest and seeing the farmland preservation separately, too. But we can color it however you want. We can group things together, whatever the preference is.
It seems to me that if you're going to do that, you have to start with this one, though. I mean, if we're going to show protected land, if somebody's reading the comprehensive plan, in a vacuum, they're going to want to know, well, okay, why is it protected? If we have a map that just shows protected land that's open to public access, that's only like part of the information.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between the state owning fee simple, right? That's one bucket in my mind, and this is a discussion, not a dictation. And there's a difference between working lands. Forest land preservation is working lands. Agricultural preservation or easements, working lands. So that's a separate bucket. And then you have private conservation groups, which to me is a third bucket. And so to me, when you look at that map, you want to see those three buckets. What is it the state owns fee simple and is state controlled? What is it's just easements? There's no public access to that except if hunting rights or something are leased out. And then the private conservation groups, which is a third bucket. To me, that is a clearer picture, but I'm just having a conversation here.
Maybe it's the other way around. You show all the protected lands, then behind it, you break it out into those buckets.
Yeah, and in the 2008 plan, there is a map in the future land use element that has developed and protected lands, and they do group all of this, I'm not exactly sure, together in a call of protected lands. And they're saying it's all federal lands, state lands, agricultural easements, private conservancy lands, major wetlands, and lands preserved by conservation easements, other conservation easements. And they group it all together and color it green.
Right. And, I think we should start, with the more concentrated group, and then you break it down as you move through the document. So if you want to break it down into subcategories, you always start with the full balance. And if you want an itemized listing, then you turn the page and you go to the itemized listing. So to me, it would make more sense to have, you know, it grouped into like three groups up front. And then if you want to break it down into subgroups as you get into the document, go ahead.
Is that, does the 161,000, just because on there's categories for it, does that include water bodies?
No.
Okay, so it's, all right.
Yeah, just the land.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Right. I have a question about the public access part. You know, I agree with public access to a point, but is public safety taken into account, or has it been talked about? Because there are a lot of bad things that go on in areas, you know, wooded areas, things like that, without, you know, mm-hmm. you want to let people in there, but you're going to have some kind of oversight to see that area is, you know, checked on and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, with the state and the federal lands, there's park rangers. I don't know about some of these, like, nature preserves, if there's anyone that monitors them, or these areas that they're considering wildlife areas, if there's any monitoring that goes on there.
But it goes to, you know, do you have enough people to go around to do that?
Right.
I don't know, but I think that needs to be really looked at, because...
Mm-hmm. And we talked about that last week when we talked about the county potentially, you know, doing more yes. park and recreation with the couple of things that they've done so far, and making sure that there's someone there to monitor it.
Okay.
So if that's, yes. you know, something the county wants to get more into with parks and recreation, it's definitely part of the conversation.
Seems like they're different. They're different things, right? I mean, you have conservation, you know, a place to, like the one guy was talking about earlier this morning, the idea of linking them together. But then you have the other issue of you know, people of all ages, kids, you know, and adults, mm-hmm. you know, going and playing or going out and you know, observing the nature and the birds, and each of those things are important. But to me, they're similar, but they're also very different, because you only need as much of that area where you do need to have the park rangers making sure that the bad stuff is not mm-hmm. going on, as you need as much as you need, and that seems like it needs to be measured. And those are, I guess, you know, maybe the areas where obviously the state needs to own. Beyond that, it seems like, you know, you have better, it seems like there's, when somebody owns something, you know, that's also conservation, they're going to be more creative on how to, you know, how to make it financially feasible, as opposed to just the state, you know, owning it. And like we've talked about a couple times, you know, when I drive by Redden State Forest and see the gate shut, and mm-hmm. that will be a recreational area. But, you know, maybe it's really not needed. Maybe there are other there's another state area 2 miles away that's also part of Redden State. Maybe that's where the people should go and hang out. But
yeah,
somehow we need to measure that and figure out, do we need more of something?
In that SCORP plan that I talked about last week that the state does, they try to measure needs, and they do a survey and determine, you know, what types of active and passive recreation are needed in all three counties in the state, and that really breaks things down a little bit more. But yeah, it's like we talked about last week, it's complicated because areas can be considered conservation, like Prime Hook, you know, it's definitely a wildlife area, but it's also recreation if you want to go there and go birding. And then it's also open space. So where do you draw the line between conservation, recreation, and open space? So I think we're kind of working all that out. Okay. The woman in Periwinkle behind us talked about the Open Space Council and the Open Space Program. So the state does a lot of the conservation efforts in the state and in Sussex County. So that's through the Open Space Program, and they coordinate the acquisition of different lands, parks, wildlife management areas, nature preserves, cultural sites. And that program was established back in 1990, and it's governed through an Open Space Council, which is a 9-member group that looks at various acquisitions every year and advises the Secretary of DENREC on purchases and easements and whatnot.
Do we know, do we have any idea how much of that's been in Sussex County?
You'll see.
Okay.
So.
So impatient.
I know.
So that council,
it's the end of the book to see how that
they preserved almost 60,000 acres across the three counties from when they started in 1990 to today. And they do most of it through fee simple, which is when you require the property completely, and also through conservation easements, which is agreements with the landowner to limit development, but they can retain their private ownership to the land. But there's other things too, like sometimes there's donations that they get, and, but these are the two primary methods. So here's the breakdown of the projects across the three counties from 1990 to the last measure was in June 30th of 2016. 44% of total projects have been in Sussex County. And you can see the acreage, 62% of the total acreage is in Sussex County across the state. So that's pretty impressive that they're investing a lot in the county.
That's almost, just doing the numbers in my head, that's maybe just a little bit over what the county actually contributes in the RTT. The counties, I think Newcastle contributes the most and Kent and Sussex contributes just slightly less. Kent's probably getting a little bit more. I mean, if you did a prorata based on the contributions to the real estate transfer tax of $10 million, it's supposed to go there. Not saying it does.
Okay. And then this map shows the land that's been acquired through the program. And there was work that was done by the state prior to 1990, obviously. Those are the lands in green. And then other projects in blue. So over 37,000 acres since 1990 under that program through fee simple or conservation easement. Okay. So the Ag Preservation Program is another.
Before you move on, I want to interrupt you. I guess the question is, if we're restricting public access to lands that we own, then why would we buy more land for public access?
Say it again.
We have public lands that are owned by the state fee simple, but we restrict public access on some of those lands. Mm-hmm. But then we're also saying, at least I'm hearing a conversation, that we need to buy more fee simple land for public access, and I can't reconcile the two.
So you're saying why not open up the land that...
Yeah, why buy more if you already have some and just open it up?
I mean, it might be restricted for various reasons. Maybe the habitat there is sensitive and it would be detrimental to open it up for public access, or maybe it is a public safety issue, like was mentioned, that they don't have someone to monitor it. I really don't know.
Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, wouldn't your dollars go further if it wasn't a fee? Fee simple means the state owns it, right?
Yeah, it was purchased.
So,
completely.
Yeah, you would be better off to buy a conservation easement.
That's what I mean. Yeah,
right? If you're not going to allow public access, right? And just put some stipulation on the easement if there's certain conditions, and then you don't have public access. And you don't have the liability of maintaining the property. It seems like such a waste of money.
I'm not sure that tying public access to the acquisition of open space or of conserved land is really necessarily the thing to do. If we're trying to conserve land, we have money to invest in either easements, as Marty says, or in actual property, whether or not it has public access could be, I don't know that has to be part of the initial decision, because we see what the issues are with public access. It's one of those things, it's a great idea, but you, every time you create public access, you create the opportunity for bad actors to act badly. And not that we shouldn't do it, but we have to be a bit judicious about how we do it and where we do it. And conservation, in my mind, is not necessarily tied to public access.
Well, I think this conversation is coming up because Todd, when he was here last week, said that an initiative of council lately with the money they're investing is they really would like to see public access with land that they're purchasing.
Right, and all I'm saying is that other issues come with that. I mean, that's a noble that's a noble undertaking, but it may not be the first consideration. Just my opinion.
I was just going to say, Marty, What I don't, with, I agree with you on the conservation, because you can get more for your dollar if you do the easement. I just don't want to get us into the point where, and I don't think you're going there, but where that's all we should do, because there may be certain tracts of land where you got somebody who's going to sell it and they're not interested in an easement.
Right.
And it may be that somebody wants to preserve that for whatever reason. You know, I don't want to get us in the point where we're just only.
No, we discussed that at the state level with open space, because there's been an ongoing conversation about how much land does the state really need to own, and is there a better way to leverage that? And there are situations where people simply don't want to be in the Ag Land Preservation Program for whatever reason.
Yeah, right.
Okay?
They just want to be gone.
Or they're in an estate settlement situation where they have to act within a time frame for an estate settlement, and so Ag Land Preservation isn't conducive to that. So open space has the ability to do easements. They don't do it. As far as I know, they haven't used that option. But they could step in, and they could buy it fee simple and then sell the easement rights to the Ag Land Preservation over time, which would allow that money to come back in to repeat that process. That could be done, but I don't think it's really being seriously discussed.
So talking about ag land preservation, the state's ag preservation program has three different types. There's the districts, which are 200 acres or more. They're preserved from development for about 10 years with the option to renew. And so the landowner still has the land, and they're voluntarily part of the district program. And like I said, at the end of 10 years, they can either renew, they can sell their land permanently as fee simple, or they can, you know, get out of the program and do what they want with their land. Expansions, it's pretty much the same thing, just less than 200 acres. And then easements, where the owner sells the development rights permanently and preserves the land. And then here's the breakdown of those acreages in the three types.
So, hey, just sitting here thinking about this, the Ag Preservation Program, it's a 10-year program. What's the commission's thoughts on even whether that's relevant for the plan? If we're doing a 10-year plan, at some point during the plan, it's going to come off the map,
right?
Potentially. And I'm not saying it should be or shouldn't be. I throw that out for discussion, because it's not all the other acreages or parcels are permanent to some degree or other. Is there any thought to how that should be treated, if it should be in a different bucket, you know, like you were talking about?
They have in the annual report, they have a number of acreage that comes out, and it's not a real simple process. It's not real horribly complicated, but it is a structure. And as I understand it, a certified letter, so a person goes in a district, they have a 10-year commitment. That doesn't mean they've sold the development rights. They've just locked up for 10 years. That at the end of that 10-year period, I believe it's 6 months prior to the expiration, they would have to send a certified letter saying that they no longer wanted to continue. They want to opt out, or they automatically get renewed for another 10 years.
Yeah, that's what I wasn't sure about.
I forget the word they use, but the amount of acres that come out is actually a small amount. It's surprising. And there's discussion, again, it's been ongoing for a while, about reducing that to 5 years, because at the 10-year contractual period, people's lives change significantly. People get cancer, they die. I mean, life things happen. And they find themselves in an awkward situation of having maybe 7 years left on a 10-year commitment, and they're like, holy cow, I've put myself in a bad box. And so there's been talk about reducing that to 5 years just to alleviate these unanticipated circumstances, but I don't think anything has been done to my knowledge. But as far as it expects the comp plan, you know, I don't think we should worry about it. It's been the program's been in effect for quite a while. We haven't seen a huge turnover of properties. There's a waiting list for people to sell their development rights at, what, last year, 71% or something discount, which is absolutely amazing. It's really a good opportunity, as I've promoted, expanding the purchase of density to other residential districts. It's quite a leveraging opportunity to, as Dennis Forty mentioned, of really impacting the total number of acres. When you figure a 70% discount on value, you figure a leveraging of at least 2-to-1, in many cases 3 or 4-to-1, you're looking at over a 10-year period. I can't remember, I didn't bring that spreadsheet today that I gave you, Vince, but a huge significant 30,000-60,000 acre impact in a 10-year period. If you do easements, for the majority not saying not doing simple, fee simple, because there are going to be situations where fee simple is appropriate, so I'm not saying it's not. But if you do the majority on easements and then you have some for fee simple, you can really impact that with leveraging to a very significant number of acres.
Could we probably, then it's, I think it's worth in the plan in just a few sentences, not because I don't make it long, but explain that. Because if you see, if you're reading the plan, you know, not us who know all about it, but if you're reading it and you see that we're talking about preservation of open space and you see that it's a 10-year window, mm-hmm. without an explanation like what Marty just gave, it would call into question the yeah. significance of that. Yeah. It's almost like you're, you know.
And I think some scenarios, and this is, I mentioned this months and months ago, that, you know, the plan is a story that we're telling, you know, with some recommendations perhaps, or we're opening doors. And I think everybody has to understand that if we need to do some scenarios, if we trade off some minor density increases from 2 to 3 or 3 to 4, this is the potential impact for resource preservation. So it's not dictating that we do any of that. It's just getting a better understanding of if we do this, this occurs, and if we do something else occurs. Because there's going to be a policy debate after this is over on ordinance, and you know we want to set up the discussion so that the information is available for whatever scenario gets decided, that nobody can say, well, I didn't realize that. And I can provide you, Alexis, with the spreadsheet I did for Vince.
What's that spreadsheet, Marty?
I just did a simple Excel spreadsheet. It's something I do when I have mathematical problems just to get clarity. And I don't have it with me, so I
neither.
It's okay. I can get it to you. And all I did was I took the preservation numbers, basically, from the situation report. I took the average unit. I can't remember if I used your number, 1.9 or minor 1.6, that we're doing now. I did a by right of 2, which is the county's base density. And then I did a thing, if you bought one extra and you averaged 3, if you bought 2 extra, you averaged 4, and I think I went up to 5. And then that money went in at a lower rate than today, because today's rate is too high, then this would be the acreage impact of conservation. Not saying where that acreage would be, but just in a broad stroke. And then what I can't do, and what I don't have the ability to do, because I don't have the numbers, access to accurate numbers anyway, is the ancillary impact of that. So if I preserve 60,000 acres in the county in the next 10 years, how much money does that save in road infrastructure cost and sewer and water and that sort of stuff? Because that's an ancillary impact. You know, you already know you get the wildlife habitat that comes with it, you get the groundwater recharge and all those things, you get working economic development because you solidify agriculture, the industry of agriculture. But I don't know the savings that it would generate. I don't have a good enough number to throw a swag on that. But I'll try to get it to you, and then you can look at it and do a devil's advocate, you know, check my math. And then we'll go back and forth until we get something that you think is presentable.
And this is the map showing the districts or expansions and then the easements, which are the permanent.
You know, I look at that map, and what surprised me, I was doing some research up in the Milford area, east of Route 1. It's really kind of amazing
yeah.
that in that area, with the resource that is available to it, that there's that much preservation, and we should take advantage of that.
That surprised me, too. I had to double-check that when I mapped it.
It's kind of a cool thing because mm-hmm. it's not an area you would think that would happen.
Okay, so another program is the Delaware Forest Land Preservation Program. That has an option for doing farmland or forest land preservation areas, which requires 10 acres or more of forest land preserved from development for at least 10 years. And then there's also easements that are purchased too, which is, you know, permanent preservation. And then this shows the breakdown of acreage between those two types of preservation for forest land. So about 8,000 acres there. And then there's also the Forest Legacy Program, which is a federal program that gives money to the states to protect working forest lands in specific areas. So there's two of these forest legacy areas in the county, the Redden-Ellendale area and the Cypress Swamp area. So there's you're eligible for potentially purchasing or selling your property if you're in one of those areas. And then this shows the preservation areas versus the easements for forest land in the county.
This is a place where, with a little imagination, Mr. Forney's thought could really come to fruition, and that many of the forested lands that are not in tree farm, not in necessarily forest land for pulp or roundwood, is along these branches. And you know, if the county had the funding mechanism and the foresight to follow the map, the circle, and look for those opportunities before the developer came in to the property owner, those easements could probably be gotten at a very reasonable price, independent of the forest preservation program. Some of them may not meet those requirements. So you may have to look for other sources. NRCS, for example, has wetland restoration programs and that sort of thing, or wetland enhancement programs. Some of those are 3-to-1 match, 75% federal funds. So, you know, I think this is a place where, you know, if we had the funding, we could pursue a more aggressive approach to preserving those resources.
There's another conservation area called natural areas, and Delaware, the state, enacted a natural areas preservation system in 1978, and essentially it inventories natural areas statewide and the system of nature preserves. So natural areas are areas where land or water, or both land and water, whether public or private, retains or has natural character, unusual flora, fauna, biologic, geological, scenic, architectural features, etc. And this is the map showing what are considered natural areas by the state. And like I said, they can be either public or private. It just shows that they're biologically significant. So that's the overlay with the hatched, the red hatched.
Oh.
And then the green is just the forest cover of the state. And this is the map that was in Euro 8 plan that I updated, just to show the overlay over the forest land. Okay, so let's talk wetlands now.
Is there any such thing as unnatural land? I'm just, it's
just a special
just a
word.
Just a fanboy
thinking
over here.
Yeah, it's a specific word that came out of that that code in 1978. Okay. All right, so there's two types of wetlands, those that are tidal, and they're generally regulated by the state and federal law. And then there's the non-tidal, which are regulated by some federal law, such as Army Corps of Engineers. So this shows the floodplains on top of your tidal and non-tidal wetlands. And these wetlands, this GIS layer was developed, I think, by NRCS. It's like a collaborative USGS, NRCS. They did their own update to the wetlands. But DENREC has its own wetland regulatory maps on file, too.
So hold on this. So these are... I have to say, I'm a bit concerned about including in our plan tidal, but specifically non-tidal wetlands that have not been designated as such.
And it was done in 08 that way, so that's just why I'm showing it today, but we can definitely change
it up. Well, and DENREC has done that again, where they have put on online a map of, I don't know what the right descriptive term would be, where they sort of think wetlands would be. And the problem with it is that it creates confusion by the public, because it leads you to believe that because it's on an official DENREC, and I don't know if it's still up or not, give me that caveat, but because it's an official DENREC website, it leads you to believe that somehow or another these have been officially determined wetlands. And as we all know, if something's a wetland, that leads to all sorts of regulations. It's misleading,
suspect.
And I just don't want us to make that same, I don't know if it's a mistake or what, that's probably too strong a term, but I don't want us to put something that will create confusion in the public within our plan. And I realize that I'm not criticizing you for doing that because it was in the OA plan, but.
Now, the wetlands are still up, I mean, on the Dead Rock site.
Yeah.
They've been for a while. And they're in error. I mean, we know they're in error time and again.
The issue I have with it is it sets up a situation where you now have to prove that the land is not wetland.
Like disprove it.
You have to disprove what they're suggesting.
Well, you do that anyway. The fines are so severe that you don't want to do that after the fact.
Right.
So you do it up front. It cost me $12,000 to do some just recently, but I know they're in error because I just went through that in the last 2 years. Every acre on a 40-some acre parcel was wetland, and we got done. I think 4 were actually wetlands, which is kind of surprising, but that's a whole different story. But you know, when the government can't tell the difference between water and land, it makes your head spin. But nevertheless, I mean, so I know that the Denrack freshwater wetlands are in error. I'm not going to argue with the title. I think they're more clearly defined. And they are covered under state law.
And again, this is not the Denrack.
Yeah, I have the disclaimer.
Right.
And I couldn't, I wasn't able to download those Denrack.
Yeah, what's the basis for this one, for the non-title?
So this is, like I said, was done in collaboration. I think USGS and NRCS and maybe another party work together to come up with these, and even when you download them from the state's website, it has a disclaimer that says these are not the Denrack regulatory wetlands. They just are used to show the extent of them.
And can you explain what the approximate and detailed
thing
is?
Yeah, so the 1% annual chance flood area, flood zone, is essentially your 100-year floodplain. FEMA's moved to this new terminology over recent years, 1% chance instead of saying 100-year floodplain.
Mm-hmm.
So the detailed means that base flood elevations were determined for that area. So do you know what the BFE is, your base flood?
Mm-hmm.
And then the ones where there wasn't a BFE done is the other areas.
Okay.
So they didn't go to the level of detail where they determine the base flood elevations in those areas.
Okay.
Personally, Alexis, I think we should take the non-titles off. The EPA is even going through a complete review of that, the regulatory. God only knows what that, it could be more or it could be less. I don't know how that's going to turn out.
Does everyone agree? Take the non-title off? Okay.
I'd agree.
Are we going to have any concerns getting this through?
We can talk about it in the text.
Yeah, I think it might be an item of concern from Denrack as we go through the approval process, but we need to at least reference it somehow in writing that mm-hmm. there are non-title wetlands in the county.
Yeah, and
look at the ones that are actually.
To me, and I don't have such an issue with putting it in text. I have more of a concern about
the maps,
and you look at that map and you say, here's my property, and wait a second.
It's
you know.
The maps. Right. We're testifying to something we don't know is true, and I have a big problem with that.
And we require that anyway.
If you don't know, and you shouldn't be speculating, on something like that.
I mean, application we get on a site plan would require
they're going to have to do the delineation anyway, and that's where so I don't know that it adds any value.
And I believe even on Denrack's website with their online viewer of the wetlands, it says you need to have get a delineation done.
Yeah, but the problem with it is that people are going to that website and they're seeing it and they're seeing their property on it, and there's different governmental agencies that are saying, well, this map shows that there's wetlands on your property. Back to your point, you've got to disprove
now
it.
Now you have to prove that there aren't, and I just have an issue with that. I mean, it's not something that we need to be doing, in my opinion.
Especially if we've got, so the layers of confusion are increased by the fact that we apparently have one Denrack map that's different from this one, which is different from what's real wetland, which one do you even pick, I think we can deal with it probably effectively in the text.
For the purposes of the land use plan, I don't think that the speculation about where wetlands are is really going to affect our plan
But I mean, other than that, to me, I think that's a useful map with the flood areas, because that's in the tidal wetlands, because I think the tidal wetlands are fairly well.
That's well known, and we get that. It's the non-titles are the ones that are an issue.
I do want to point out that in the future land use element of the 08 plan, in that protected lands shape file that they rolled everything together, they're including major wetlands in that. So I think that they're using the title wetlands.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, we'll have to still get to that when we get to the future land use map and that information. Yeah. But
so yeah. What's the direction?
I don't know that there was the same issues there are now with that. With, you know, it's come to the forefront here in the past 6 months or so.
We're still ditching the non-tidal wetlands, correct?
I would say for
map
now.
On the map.
But yeah. Keep the title on the map?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I don't think there's an issue with the title. They're pretty well known, but it's the speculative nature of the non-tidal wetlands designation just bothers me, and I don't think we need to encourage it. Anybody coming in has got to do a delineation anyway. I mean, mm-hmm. So it's just not a...
Oh, no. We're just having a side conversation. Okay. About.
All right, so take non-title off the map, keep the title, and talk about the non-title in the text.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That sounds good.
Just and reference the federal rule or law or whatever.
Yeah.
And then we'll figure out what to do
and
when we get to the future
land use element. You could probably put almost like the disclaimer in the text, you know, that something along the lines is there are, you know, I don't know what the wording would be, whether you'd want to say significant amount of wetlands, but because that's subject to a separate delineation, it's determined on...
Yeah, I think you can certainly talk about that in the text and explain why we're doing what we're doing.
Right.
And you can talk about the importance of them, you know,
right.
Or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's no question about any of that.
Well, and mention that we require, you know, a wetland delineation statement on the site plan.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Okay, so these are the major watersheds in the county, and they're called hydrologic unit codes, HUC codes. You can break down watersheds very big to smaller level. This is the level that was looked at in the 08 plan. So these are the watersheds.
So this is, can we go back to that? Mm-hmm. And this one, for the benefit of the commission, I know Marty and I have talked about this. So this has two kind of roles that make it important, at least in the 08 plan. One is so you know where the watersheds are, but the second is with the bonus density. You know, if somebody comes in and they acquire bonus density in development, the land that's acquired for open space or conservation or whatever you want to call it is supposed to be used within the watershed where that project was located. The reason for that was, you know, if you're going to offset density, you want to, and this was back when they adopted that, it doesn't make sense to allow greater density in the Herring Creek or Hoboth Bay one and then purchase, open space in Gum Branch. They wanted to try to have some nexus between where the bonus density was purchased and where it was, or where the money was funded by and where the open space was acquired. So just sort of an explanation on that, because I don't know with some of the newer members if you realize that.
Was that in guidance or in ordinance?
I think that's in the ordinance. I'm fairly certain.
Too.
Yeah.
It's in the ordinance.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Loose.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Didn't Todd say it was, Mr. Lawson say it was loose last week?
I'm not sure. I'm fairly certain it's in the ordinance. I haven't gone back and checked. But the other thing is that, you know, at some level, too, and I guess back to your point, it depends on how you define the watersheds. If you can move that line around, that you can, you know, move around where you're going to acquire open space. I just bring that up because it plays an important role with how we're going to define the watersheds in this map or whether we want to do away with that use in the bonus density trade. You know, whether you want to go to something bigger, I don't know, like the hundreds may be bigger or, you know.
Well, you know, I think that's step two in ordinance. When we ever get to that, we'll have a probably detailed conversation of that. I think, you know, right now, it's important that we try to focus, in my opinion, on a process and a funding mechanism to achieve natural resource conservation in a general sense. How they do it specifically in ordinance will be a step two process, and we'll have to get to
but
that.
But the strategy would be to look at the ordinance and determine if
and
the
I agree with that, but if we're going to, if currently the ordinance is tied to watersheds, you know, we need to think about, all right, if we're going to relate it back to some map in our plan, what's the appropriate
Well, you know,
map?
Maybe a whole, more holistic approach needs to be considered.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to lock anything in because you don't know what the council's going to want to ultimately do. They might want to go like, well, if it all drains into the inland bays, well, then forget the individual watersheds and do an inland bay thing. Or they might want to do, who cares, wherever they decide to in the county. So, you know, maybe some language just says we should, you know, consider, you know, how any conservation be done in a more holistic fashion.
So to the point with larger watersheds, those these are the TMDLs in the county. So a TMDL is essentially they're required for waterways that don't meet the state's water quality standards, and they're reported on a list. It's called the 303D list. And the Clean Water Act, the federal act, requires states to develop a TMDL for pollutants of concern in those waterways. And essentially, a TMDL is kind of a limit on pollution that can be discharged into the water body. So you have the Inland Bays Atlantic Ocean TMDL, the Chesapeake Bay TMDL, and the Delaware Bay TMDL in the county. And then there's three different types where TMDLs are required for nitrogen, phosphorus, and then bacteria. And you can see the limits vary at a smaller level based on watersheds.
Alexis, did you get this handout from Dennis?
Uh-huh.
You know, maybe we can even mention this, you know, just as a, as you know, here's maybe one perspective as well, that this this preservation loop be given consideration. Mm-hmm. It might be another concept as opposed to, inland bays or whether it's in a watershed, it's a as a more holistic approach.
Going back to the other.
Yeah,
so for land other. Preservation, yeah. But yeah, TMDLs have to be required. They're required by law.
But
so
I'm
this
also
is something
thinking
separate.
That, you know, somebody might say, well, okay, let's not do it by watershed. Let's do it by TMDL area. Or maybe we could do it using the preservation loop. Or maybe there's another thought of ways to conserve lands in a whole more holistic fashion. I'm just very concerned that by watershed is too restricting. I think maybe that's where you were going.
That's where I was going.
Yeah, yeah, so it sounds like there needs to be a strategy about revisiting the code about the density bonus to determine if the watershed basis is the best way of, allocating
bonus. And
that
was sort of my point, just because that map was up there, so you can visually see this is how that currently talks.
Yeah, it could be really very restricting.
Yeah.
You may just not have any takers. Now you've got all this money just sitting there. Right. And you're not even utilizing.
Okay. All right, we talked about flooding. We talked about the hazard mitigation plan. I'm just going to skip ahead here.
Was your thought on the text of the hazard mitigation plan to just include reference to that?
Yeah, reference it, and then when we talk about strategies, if there's specific strategies that help mitigate flooding, because flooding is the number one hazard identified in the plan, and if you guys want to talk about sea level rise or climate change, that could tie back in as well.
Just, I think
or erosion,
it's
coastal
know
erosion.
The public realizes that we even have a hazard mitigation plan.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I told you before that I've worked on hazard mitigation plans before, and I worked for FEMA on developing ways to integrate hazard mitigation plans and comp plans. It's really a big initiative of FEMA to integrate the two. So it's great that the county's doing it. They're a nice model that FEMA might catch wind of and showcase you in the future. Okay. Let's talk about buffers. So this is talk about the different regulations that Sussex County has for conservation. So one regulation is buffer zones for wetlands and tidal and perennial non-tidal waters. That's in the code. The code requires a 50-foot buffer zone from the mean high water line of tidal waters, tidal tributary streams, tidal wetlands, and the ordinary high water line of perennial non-tidal rivers and non-tidal streams. It's a mouthful, but that's, I guess, how it's measured. It's 50-foot buffer in the code. Another regulation is the coastal area protection regulations, and that's essentially language to assist in preserving dunes during construction. You all know about the ESDA overlay zone, the floodplain ordinance as well. Source water protection ordinance, sediment control and stormwater management ordinance, and then the water sewer recent, the chapter 110 as well, have conservation regulations. Conservation zones. So this is in your code, and it established a 1,000-foot area of land landward from the mean high water line of tidal water bodies, and had requirements for increased lot size for parcels that proposed sewer septic systems and on-site wells. And this is the map from that. And I think this tied back to which comp plan? It was like 1980 or something, right?
I know it's referred back in the 90 plan, and then it refers back to like the 88 plan. So this might be, you know, something we might want to take a look at, you know, making sure it still makes sense and that those boundaries still make sense.
Is this referred to much in everyday practice? Is it used? Is it?
It is, because there are a lot of properties within 1,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's still appropriate. I don't, unless somebody has some reason to change it, the lines. I mean, I think 1,000 foot is still enough. Is there a reason to adjust it?
Well, it also doesn't impact Western Sussex County at all. This just impacts the water bodies on the eastern or a portion of the eastern side. The map does, which means the text only qualifies because the text references the maps. And the maps, while it's in the Western Sussex County plan of whenever it was done, 88 or 90, there are no maps for protecting the waterways on the western side.
The only title you have
is the Manicoke. Right?
But I always thought that we, and maybe I'm wrong, but I thought we applied that with the lot size requirements, et cetera, on the Manicoke too, even regardless whether it was mapped. You know, because you would show, like somebody came in with a site plan, it would show where that line was.
Yeah, because the code lots. Talks from the mean high water line of tidal water body, so it doesn't matter what the map says, right?
Yeah.
Right, but it's as referenced in the plan. As references so the map that references in the plan. So
we're saying we should put 1,000 foot on the Nanticoke.
I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying right now the section of the code only references the tidal water bodies on the eastern, a portion of the eastern side as shown on the map.
It's probably some, whether it's comp plan or code, a fix, because I think it's always been 1,000 everywhere.
From tidal, yeah.
Right, and
it's tidal. You know, right. What's the difference between the misbelief?
But it's just that it's not mapped.
Right, yeah.
Right, so if there's tidal not mapped per this, it's not, right now it does not have to comply.
But the effect, it doesn't?
I thought it did.
I got a legal opinion about it. We've run into the situation that it is tidal, but it is beyond the 1,000 foot. That is the buffer shown on the maps, which is...
Well, if it's beyond, it's beyond.
But what you're saying, if it's on the western side, it's not mapped.
Correct.
You're saying that
it does not have to comply with that section of code.
Maps updated then, seems to me.
So then we should draw a 1,000-foot map over the tidal portions of the Nanticoke.
If you so choose.
I mean, because that's even a fairness issue, let alone an environmental one, it seems to me, you know? I mean, if it's tidal, it's tidal.
Was it left out intentionally for a reason?
I can't answer why it was the way the code was written the way it is. And it was not mapped. I've gone through both of those comp plans, and they do not map any of the water bodies on the western side. And then if there's title that you want to expand here, this would be an opportunity to expand it as well.
I think 1,000 foot is enough. It's just the issue of should we do the Nanticoke title. So, and I think probably we should, if that's what the code reads, then we should do the map.
So, potential strategy here? Sounds like it.
Look at potentially
updating
the maps.
The map for the tidal portion of the Nanticoke.
Okay.
Is this map, that map in the 08 plan? I can't remember.
No.
Yeah.
This isn't actually in the 08 plan.
It isn't even, I don't think it's even talked about in the 08 plan.
Okay.
It's not.
No, it's the code that references the 90 and the 88 plans.
So that's a strategy then. That was my question, whether they need to update the map for the plan, which sounds like we don't. It's a strategy to update the code and the map, whatever that's referenced in the code.
Any other questions on this? So moving on to talk about the county's role, we're talking about the regulations. The county also provides grants. We talked about that last week a bit with the recreation and open space. These are a few conservation-related grants that Gina pulled out from fiscal year 17, different drainage projects, soil conservation district, and then some little piecemeal things like Delaware Ducks Unlimited for a conservation festival.
You only have the 1 year?
Yeah, I mean, I can have her pull more, but this was just to show a little snapshot of things that the county does.
Okay.
And then last time we talked about these, we can go through these again, about the bonus density open space contributions, that there's been three of those since, three of them totaling $1.4 million, and they have not been spent. We talked about that last week. Okay. The work with the land trust, so the county was contributing to the land trust up until fiscal year 2013, and then the actual purchase, the last purchase was in 2010. And then here's that breakdown with the county contributions and then the acreages that were acquired.
Does that include the match?
I think that's the county contribution.
Yeah, this is only the county funds that have been set aside.
Yeah, the
or
expense,
spent.
Yeah. Right. So there's some money left there too.
That's okay. One probably for a strategy or goal is to, from the way, it just sounds like there needs to be a better coordinated effort to find lands and acquire them. You know, it sounds like from Mr. Forney stated that there's a hierarchy, maybe there's the county, we don't know it, but it strikes me that there needs to be some more organization.
Well, it's almost like having a lockbox. You say, okay, I'm going to put this money aside for preservation, but it has to be in the watershed and it has to be fee simple, and then there's nothing in the watershed fee simple available to purchase, so then the money sits there. And so we need to somehow in the language of the document explain that we can't put so many strings attached that the money sits there unused. You know, we need to be flexible enough to be able to utilize those funds.
And it sounds like it's somewhat ad hoc too, you know, like there's $1.167 million sitting there, but I don't know that there's any, well, I guess the land trust is, in that case, that's contributed. So that is the land trust. That's not the county money, then. That's the land trust that's actually acquiring that property.
Yeah, those are land trust funds.
All right, yeah. I was thinking the money that the county was holding from the bonus density.
And that's why the number is so high, because they were doing some fee simple and some other stuff, but they also had some contributions in that.
Yeah, and I was thinking of the money that was coming from the bonus density, which is different from that.
That's sitting there as well, the $1.4 million.
This, right. Mm-hmm. This is the one that there needs to be better, I think, coordination on how to spend it.
Right. I don't know if there's stipulations on the land trust money the way there is.
The contributors can place stipulations. So if a person went to the land trust and says, I want to give you a dollar, and they can say, but here's my stipulations on how you can spend it.
And it sounds like from what Mr. Forney said, on the land trust spends, they have, 35 sort of bullets, and they try to rank them, you know, based on, and I just don't know that the county. They may, but I'm not aware that there's that level of organization or somebody dedicated to actually trying to figure that out, you know?
Well, I think that the land trust...
Particularly if we're going to get more aggressive in doing it.
I think the land trust has liberty to use their own ranking system, but it has to be right now, at least. It hasn't always been that way, but right now it has to be fee simple acquisition within the watershed. And that is causing a problem, and I think, I'm not on the board, and finding
land. No, I think the watershed's the county one. So the watershed's the one that comes in from the bonus density.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. And the bonus density, the reason that 1.4 million is sitting there, and it may sit there a little while, from what I understand, by just word of mouth, because of the stipulations, they're having trouble finding land that meets the county's requirement.
Is the reason, do we know why the county didn't put money in the last 3 years?
No money, no 2000.
Was it because they were waiting for this, they were trying to get matching funds from the state, was then trying to get matching funds from
the
federal government?
No, in 2009, the budget went down, they reduced the budget by 17%, and part of the reduction was no more money. I mean, there just wasn't any money there. Now, of course, we've recovered, and if they wanted to, they probably could. They just maybe choose not to, I don't know.
Okay, because I knew the state was having the deal with, you know, we're not putting money in, which means we're not getting federal funds that we could match, which I thought was also
like last year,
the county wasn't doing it because the state wasn't doing it, so we weren't, yeah.
Well, last year the state had some carryover money, like Open Space has some carryover money. I don't know if they have any left carryover this year, but the federal government has matched that could be matched with.
Right, my point was that if there is federal money and we're not putting it in because the state wasn't putting in, is there some way the county could just go straight for the federal money rather than just try to go through the state?
Or they could still use the land trust to do that, even though the land trust didn't have a match. They could still use the mechanism.
But I'm not sure of how the whole thing worked. That's why I was asking the question.
So the last county contribution to the state's Farmland Preservation Program was in 2009 as well, and you can see that here. So there's some remaining funding sitting there. Okay. So next I have the goals, objectives, strategies discussion. Do we want to break now before we dig into that?
Yeah, it's probably a good idea.
Natural break, yeah.
Okay. All right, then. We will adjourn for 30 minutes.